I want to. This presentation this evening, I knew from the outset, is kind of theoretical. I don't know if that's the right word, the expression for it, but I want to be a little bit theoretical again here in terms of setting some things on the board to try to illustrate the fifth and sixth trumpet. So I hope that I can do this in a simple enough fashion that you can follow me. This line here is the beginning of the fifth trumpet, the first woe. This is the end of the fifth trumpet. It's also the beginning of the sixth trumpet. Now, I try to have a healthy reverence and respect for the pioneers of Adventism. I honestly and fully know that they were much better Bible students than I've ever been. And I mean that from every part of my being. But there's some things the pioneers were incorrect on. And some of the things they are incorrect on are very easy to explain. And you don't cause a stumbling block for anyone. They were forced by logic to try to see all the prophecies were concluded by 1844 because they thought the world was coming to an end by 1844. So when you look at what they're saying about Revelation 17, there's no way it corresponds with the end of the world because they were trying to force Revelation 17 into a conclusion before 1844. So that's pretty easy one for us as Seventh-day Adventists to look back on. And someone says, well, they were wrong on that. We don't stumble on it. But the pioneers were pretty much in agreement that the sixth trumpet, the second woe, that it ended in 1840. August 11th, 1840, with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, and I disagree with them. So I'm being out front that I disagree with them. And one of my logical reasons that I disagree with them, and by logical I mean, is that by the time they hit 1840 and got involved with that experience that led into the Midnight Cry and then the Great Disappointment, those that stayed on board with the message began the work of trying to understand the disappointment and began the work of coming to grips with what the Sabbath was and began the work of putting together a church. And logically, to me, I see a justifiable reason why they didn't go back in and reinvestigate the sixth trumpet, the second woe, too closely. So I don't have a problem that they did not understand, as I do, that the sixth trumpet ends when the seventh trumpet begins on October 22nd, 1844. But each of you, if you get involved with this study, as you should, because every Seventh-day Adventist is called to be a student of prophecy, you're going to have to decide for yourself whether what I'm saying is erroneous or what the pioneers understood about the end of the sixth trumpet was correct. They said that it ended on August 11th, 1840. I'm saying it ended here. Now, I'm going to try to explain a little bit of the theoretical reason here why I think they were incorrect. But I want to point you to one hurdle, if you're going to maintain the pioneer position, that I think that you have to get over. You're going to have to demonstrate in a consistent fashion. You're going to have to deal with this, let me put it that way. In 1842, William Foy had a vision, and he had it recorded, that an angel told him in 1842 that the sixth trumpet was still sounding. Now, you may not be familiar with the sixth trumpet, second woe, you may not have studied it, but the pioneers believed and taught in their writings that the sixth trumpet ended on August 11th, 1840. The pioneers also taught that William Foy was genuinely inspired of the Lord. And William Foy said that in 1842, the sixth trumpet was still sounding. So the pioneers have a problem with inspiration there that needs to be resolved. And I don't ever see them ever addressing it. They quote William Foy's vision. They quote his statements. But evidently, they just never, seen the logic that they were disagreeing with themselves, either on one side of the issue or the other. So that isn't my argument. By the way, that isn't my argument. I believe the pioneers were wrong for probably over a year before I was confronted with, before I ever looked at William Foy's vision. And that's another story in itself. But this is the fifth trumpet, first woe, sixth trumpet. This history here is the sixth trumpet. This history is the fifth trumpet. I want to show you something here, if you will see it. In the fifth trumpet, there is a time prophecy. If you look at Revelation 9, verse 5, it says, and this is the fifth trumpet, first woe, it says, and to them it was given, to Islam it was given, that they should not kill them. They're going to bring warfare against Europe, and I'm putting that in modern terminology. They're going to bring warfare against Europe in the fifth trumpet, the first woe, but they're not going to kill Europe. They're not going to kill the emperors of Eastern Rome in the first woe. They're just going to hurt them. They're going to begin the warfare of Islam against Christianity. But they should be tormented 5 months. And if you drop down to verse 10, this time prophecy is repeated. It says, and they had tails like unto scorpions, and their sting was in their tails, and their power was to hurt men 5 months. So this time prophecy of 5 months is twice mentioned in the fifth trumpet. What's a month in Bible prophecy? 30 days. What's 5 times 30? 150. There's a time prophecy of 150 years in the fifth trumpet. Pioneers understood it. And the pioneers mark this, the beginning of this time prophecy, when Ottoman, who do you suppose Ottoman is? He's the one that gets the credit for the Ottoman Empire. When Ottoman, he brings together the warriors of Islam into an organized fighting group. And he did it at a specific battle. He rallied Islam into an organized fighting group prior to that time period. And this is approximately for 400 years. Islam was warring against the Europeans, but it was a band of Islamic terrorists over here and a band over there and a band over there. There was nothing organized. But at the Battle of Nicomedia, and I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, but you can look it up in Uriah Smith's book and pronounce it for yourself. It's Nicomedia. At the Battle of Nicomedia, they mark the beginning point of this 150-year time prophecy, because this is where Ottoman rallies the troops and they begin to really, really cause havoc for the Europeans for 150 years. And this battle is the starting of this, so it's marked in history. And the battle here was July 27th, 1299. When this 150 years is over, that is the end of the fifth trumpet. It is also simultaneously the beginning of the sixth trumpet, and it is also simultaneously the beginning of the time prophecy in the sixth trumpet. When this 150 years ends on July 27th, 1449, 150 years later, this is when the four angels of Revelation 9, 14, and 15 that are loosed, that are prepared for an hour, a month, and a day, and a year. So at this very ending of the fifth trumpet, at the ending of the 150 years, begins the 391 years and 15 days. Yes, it started on July, the Battle of Nicomedia was on July 27th, 1299. And the 150-year time prophecy began. And what if you put 150 years to 1299, you're going to be right at the same day of the year, right? And it's by this calculation, it's this date that allows Josiah Litch and the Millerites to calculate August 11th, 1840. Because this time prophecy was 391 years and 15 days. Follow the logic there? Everyone follow the logic? So what you do, if you do not follow the pioneer, yes.
Why is it August 15th instead of August 11th, 15 days?
Yes. Yes, July 27. It's accurate. All right. So what I want you to see, I want you to see something here at a prophetic level, if you will. If you will see this at a prophetic level. In the fifth trumpet, there are two periods of time prophetically. In the fifth trumpet. Don't worry about this side over here. We're talking about the fifth trumpet. There are two periods of time prophetically. What do I mean by that? There's this first period of time from the time period of Muhammad when there is no time prophecy. And then there's 150 years of time prophecy. If you believe that the pioneers were incorrect on saying that the sixth trumpet ended on 1840, and you accept the premise that it actually ended when the seventh trumpet began on October 22, 1844, then in the sixth trumpet, you also have two periods of time prophetically. You have a period of time of history that's governed by a time prophecy, and then you have a short period of time from 1840 to 1844 where there is no time prophecy governing the sixth trumpet. My point is this. When you approach the fifth and the sixth trumpet, and you realize that part of the history of the fifth trumpet was not governed or not covered by a time prophecy, and part of the history was covered by a time prophecy, and if you don't accept the pioneer position about 1840, then you see that the same thing is true in the sixth trumpet. And what this does, among other things, what this does, two things that to me are important, probably does more than that. But one is, it lets you see the logic between the logic concerning the seventh trumpet. Because what the pioneers correctly taught, and what I agree with, is that the seventh trumpet began to blow on October 22, 1844. But the seventh trumpet is also the third woe. Okay? It's two symbols for the same thing. The seventh trumpet is the third woe. The sixth trumpet is the second woe. The fifth trumpet is the first woe. But what we've been teaching here and what we've been purposely teaching because we think it is correct is that the seventh trumpet is representing the development of the 144,000 and the third woe is representing the crisis that takes place when the 144,000 are developed. Therefore, the trumpet and the woe, they're the same thing prophetically, but they're identifying two different aspects of that particular history. The woe is identifying the angering of the nations, the distress of nations, that the wall shall be built again in troublous times. It's the troublous times. And I'm suggesting that the woe actually begins on September 11, 2001, even though I'm saying that the seventh trumpet, as the pioneers did, began on October 22, 1844. So I'm taking the seventh trumpet and dividing it into two parts, so to speak. And one of my justifications for doing so, I would submit to you, is that you can show that both these first two woes are also prophetically divided up into two parts. One part, a history that is not covered by prophetic time. Other part, covered by prophetic time. And you see that in both these woes. And in a triple application of prophecy, the characteristics of the first woe combined with the characteristics of the second woe establish the characteristics of the third woe. So this is at least one argument to make a distinction between the sounding of the seventh trumpet, which began on October 22, 1844, and the woe aspect of the seventh trumpet. And brothers and sisters, I really think you have to do that. Even if you're not accepting how I understand the three woes, if you're going to be consistent with the pioneer understanding, the sounding of the seventh trumpet began on October 22, 1844. So what was the woe that began there? You know, where is the trouble? And if you go into the pioneer writings, they'll tell you the woe is represented. Uriah Smith says it this way. He says the first four trumpets describe just some terrible stuff. You know, when Uriah Smith talks about the second trumpet, it was Attila the Hun. That's the third trumpet. Third trumpet, Attila the Hun. And you know the stories of Attila the Hun, right? You know, when he came through a town, when he left, everyone's head in the town was piled up in a big pile. You know, it was just bad times. And then the pioneers point out that when you get to the last three trumpets, they're called woes, signifying that they're worse than the first four trumpets. So you have to describe what's the difference between the sounding of the seventh trumpet and the woe aspect, I think, if you're going to give a logical understanding of how the seventh trumpet is where the mystery of God is finished and what the woe symbolizes. And this is one part of it. There's two parts to both these histories, but that's not the important part. Now, we're still dealing with the triple application of prophecy. Notice chapter 9 in the first woe. Let's start with verse 3. And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them it was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. And this is describing the warfare of Islam. But notice verse 4. And it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which did not have the seal of God in their foreheads. Brothers and sisters, in the fifth trumpet, the first woe, here in verse 4 is a verse where Islam is told not to hurt those that have the seal of God. And if you go back into history, Abu Bakr, who's the first general of Islam after Muhammad, actually made a command to his warriors that when you go out warring against the Christian world, you're going to find two different kind of Christians. And he doesn't say Sabbath and Sunday, but as he describes the characteristics of the one group of Christians, and the characteristics of the other group of Christians. He talks about the one group of Christians that live in the convents and the closures, and they shave their heads. He's talking about the Catholic monasteries. He says, if they won't bow down and accept Allah, cut their heads off. But when you find the other Christians, leave them alone. There was actually a historical command by Abu Bakr to leave them alone. And the Adventist historians, like Truth Triumphant by Wilkerson, if you read that book, that's an easy one to get to, they document that the Christians that were getting left alone by Islam during that time period were the Sabbath-keeping Christians. So there, in that time period, there really was a test over Sabbath and Sunday. Islam was going out to make war against Christians, but it was going to leave Sabbath-keeping Christians alone. So there was a testing time, but more important, the first woe is pointing to the end of the world. And you'll notice, keep your finger there, we're not done there. If you go back to chapter 7, in verse 1, it says, and after these things I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on any tree. And then drop down to verse 3, just because of time, saying, hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till we've sealed the servants of God in their forehead. Now if you go back to verse 4 of chapter 9, notice the command of Islam. And it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, nor any green thing, nor any tree, but only those men which did not have the seal of God in their foreheads. That's why when Sister White says the four winds that these four angels in Revelation 7 are represented by an angry horse, an angry war horse, and she says this chart is directed by the hand of the Lord and should not be altered, and Islam is symbolized by an angry war horse, Sister White is saying these four winds of the four angels of Revelation 7 are represented by the same symbol that represents Islam. And in the fifth trumpet, there is a verse which describes that Islam is not going to hurt those people that have the seal of God at that point in time. And the characteristics of the first woe, combined with the characteristics of the second woe, establish the characteristics of the third woe. So what I'm saying is, in the first woe, the fifth trumpet, you have represented two things. You have the warfare that Islam brings against apostate Christianity, and you also have Islam providing protection for those that have the seal of God. Now, if you go to the sixth trumpet, the second woe, you will find that in this history of 391 years and 15 days, Islam is bringing war against Europe. If you stop the sixth trumpet right there, then you're not including 1840 to 1844 in the history of the sixth trumpet. But William Foy says the sixth trumpet's still blowing in 1842. And what I'm saying is that in the first woe, the fifth trumpet, there is a period represented when God's people are sealed. And in the second woe, the sixth trumpet, 1840 to 1844 is representing, once again, the period when God's people are sealed. It's the history that prefigures the development of the 144,000. This is the seven thunders, which Sister White says is a delineation of events that would transpire under the first and second angel's message. So in this, the first woe, you have the command to not hurt those that have the seal of God. And if you understand that the sixth trumpet goes all the way to 1844, then in this trumpet, you also have the warfare of Islam and a historical time period representing the sealing of God's people. And the characteristics of the first woe, combined with the characteristics of the second woe, establish and identify the characteristic of the third woe. Therefore, the third woe will be two parts. One part is the sounding of the seventh trumpet, which identifies the history we know as the Day of Atonement, when the 144,000 are developed and the sealing takes place. And the other part is the woe aspect, when Islam brings warfare against the armies of Rome. Too theoretical? Okay, that's in place. We read, can I repeat that? I don't know if I can repeat that. It right here, what happened? We read this tonight. What happened right here on October 22nd, 1844? What did Jesus do when he raised his hand? He proclaimed, time shall be no longer. Time ends here. If you think there's any prophetic time after that, you're going to have more prophecies than these to be looking for time aspect to. You're going to have to, you know, be plying the 42 months of the papacy at the end of the world. Prophetic time is no longer. Couldn't be any longer. Can't be any longer. Why can't it be any longer? Not just because Christ said it can't be any longer, but in 1844, from that point on, if God's people would have submitted to the commands and the dictates of the gospel and brought their life into agreement with the message of the hour, Christ would have come ere this. We're on probationary time that's only being extended due to our disobedience. There is no prophetic time. God's just waiting for us to finish the work of character development, then he will come. And Sister White said he could have come shortly after 1844. Prophetic time is no longer. The 2520 came to a conclusion on October 22nd, 1844. Now, the 2520 has two, the question was, what about the 2520? The 2520 is two time prophecies, one against the northern kingdom, one against the southern kingdom, and the 2520 years of chastisement against the northern kingdom began in 723 BC and ended in 1798, and the 2520 years of chastisement against the northern kingdom began in 677 BC and ended in 1844. Time shall be no longer.
So since 1844, the sealing time started when? Since 1844?
No, well, yes and no. I think you can say that we've been in the question is, since 1844, the sealing time started since then, and I can say, I don't have a problem if you say since 1844, in a general way, we've been in the sealing time. But Sister White identifies a sealing time. And very specifically, she has a statement we've read here once this weekend. She says the sealing time is very short. She's talking about a period of time, not a time prophecy, a period of time. But she also, looking at that from a different way, she identifies that we stopped the latter rain being poured out in the 1888 time period. So the sealing time had begun in the 1888 time period, but due to our disobedience, we stopped it. So the sealing time is a period of time at a certain point in history.
Well, does that mean that the second coming of the Lord could go on indefinitely because he's waiting for us to get our act together?
I don't think so. I don't think so. And that you, if you haven't had opportunity, anyone that's been here since Sabbath has not had an opportunity to test what we've shared here. And perhaps when you test it, you're going to conclude that it's erroneous. But had you tested what has been shared here and found it to be true, then what's established on September 11, 2001 is that the history of 1840 to 1844 has begun to be repeated again. And when you bring that history into Luke 21, Christ says, when you see these things come to pass, this generation does not pass. We're in a time period now where prophecy has cut off this time period of us wandering in the wilderness, in spite of what it may appear as we look around to Adventism, the latter rain is falling. The Lord is making up his jewels. And we can't have confidence that we will see men and women that we think are the 144,000 during this time period to give us confidence, oh yes, it's happening, because Elijah is a symbol of this time period, and Elijah thought he was the only one, and the Lord says no. There's 7,000 out there. The Lord is raising up his people now. Question in the back.
As I listen to this understanding of prophecy, I see a lot of factors factor into what we're teaching or what we're learning. My question is, how does the wedding parables that Christ taught factor into the understanding of the pioneers and the close of probation? You know what I mean? The wedding parables Jesus taught, the man that went to the wedding ceremony without the garment, and then it talked about the bridegroom returning from the wedding, and then it also talked about the wise and foolish virgins.
Well, We were heading to touch on that a little bit. I don't know that we're going to get to that tonight, because we're moving into question and answers, which is fine. I'm not threatened by that. But the parable of the 10 virgins illustrates the experience of the Advent people. Sister White says, Great Controversy 393. And she says that parable was fulfilled to the very letter in the Millerite time period, and it will be fulfilled again to the very letter. That's paraphrased, but that's what she says. Review and Herald, August 19th, 1890. And there's two stops in the parable of the 10 virgins. You know, the wedding party goes two places. So for me, I have no problem seeing that there's a call to Adventism to the marriage at the end of the 2520. The 2520 year time prophecy to the southern kingdom was teaching the lesson, covenant broken at the beginning, covenant reestablished at the end. It ended on October 22nd, 1844, when God once again entered into a covenant relationship with his people. And those people that came into that experience, they came to 1843, and the 1335-day time prophecy of Daniel 12 says, Blessed is he who cometh to the 1335, which is right here, 1335, and it comes down here to 1843. And Revelation says, Blessed is he who is called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And in 1843, those people that were going to enter into the most holy place with Christ were fully prepared to do so. And Sister White has a statement where she says that. In 1843, they were prepared. And Sister White teaches that, because Sister White teaches that character is never developed in a crisis. It's only demonstrated in a crisis. And the crisis came for them in the summer of 1844, and they went into the marriage at the beginning of the marriage. But this parable of the 10 virgins is repeated at the end, and it's repeated with the identical repeat of history. The events of 1840 that began the process of calling people into the marriage, which ultimately brings them to 1843, and the blessed is he who cometh to the marriage supper of the Lamb, preparing them to enter by faith into the most holy place. And Sister White plainly says, Christ moving into the most holy place, he's moving in there for the marriage to receive his kingdom. She said that in the Great Controversy. That is repeated at the end of the world. And where we were going tonight, although I don't know that we will get there, I'll at least give you the logic. It seems like you have a follow-up question, but I want to give you the logic while we're on this point. Brothers and sisters, the Millerite time period is repeated again to the very letter. I mean, we went over that here this weekend from a lot of different ways. It's repeated. And the history of 1840 to 1844 is the history of where God raised up the beginning of Adventism. And in that history, he's identifying the history when he raises up the end of Adventism, the 144,000. And he raises up the 144,000 just before human probation closes. And human probation closes in Daniel 12, verse 1. And we started the night with a quote from the Great Controversy where it says, "The events connected with the close of probation and the need of preparation for the time of trouble have been clearly revealed, but multitudes have no more understanding of these important truths than if they'd never been revealed." And we pointed out that the events that lead up to the close of probation is Daniel 11, 40, 41, 42, 43, 44, and 45. What prepared the Millerites to enter into the marriage on October 22nd, 1844, was this history of 1840 to 44 when Christ came down out of heaven and unsealed the book of Daniel. That's what prepared them to enter into the marriage. And in doing that, in establishing that history of 1840 to 44, he was establishing a history that's repeated at the end of the world, and therefore, the history of 1840 to 44 corresponds identically to the movements of verse 40, 41, 42, 43, 44, and 45. And brothers and sisters, you can even line them up that the year 1840 goes with verse 40, and verse 41 goes with 1841, and verse 42 goes with 1842, and verse 43 goes with 1843, right down through the verses. Why? Because the events connected with the close of probation are here. And the events connected with the close of probation is when this history of the Millerite time period is repeated to the very letter. So, it's the same thing as then. We're being called to the marriage right now. He's unsealing the revelation.
The reason why I asked the question was because my understanding of the pioneers' understanding of the midnight cry and what led up to the midnight cry was based on the wedding parables that Jesus taught. There were three wedding parables. And this is what gave impetus, along with other things that they taught, to the movement at that time to go and share the gospel with the world. And the reason why I'm asking that question is because if that is true, if we could line up this history, which I believe that it parallels the midnight cry or the 1840.
It's almost scary when you look at it, these verses lining up with that history, but go ahead.
But if we can identify it as we see it and understand it from a historical point of view, but if we can line it up through the parables of Christ, then this message could go to unbelievers today, right now, and they could clearly see it and accept it and be ready when probation closes.
I don't think so. I have a prophetic reason for saying that. Did you all understand what he's saying? Is that when they took the midnight cry to the world in 1844, you can line that up. There is no doubt the loud cry parallels the midnight cry. I'm not disagreeing with you on that point. But let me point one thing out to you. In the Millerite time period, you have 1840, the first angel's message in power. 1842, the organized churches closed the door of their probation on the message of the hour. The Protestant churches in the United States closed the door of their probation before the Millerites closed the door of their probation. That's what they did. They closed the doors of their churches. They rejected the message of the hour. And it wasn't until 1844 that the Millerites closed the door of their probation, either as wise or foolish virgins. First angel's message was in 1840. But when we come to the end of the world, where we're at now, the close of probation is reversed. When the Sunday law arrives, probation closes for Adventists first, and then it closes for the world when Michael stands up. And you can bring a lot of prophetic history here and show that there's a reversal down here at the end. And now here's my point. The message after probation closes here at the Sunday law for Adventists, and I know it closes progressively for different countries around the world, but the message that is the final warning message for the world is a revelation of the character of God, the revelation of God's love that is carried to the world by the 144,000 through their personal experience and their personal testimony during the greatest crisis that there's ever been. This message here is the message of the 144,000 is the loud cry message that brings God's other children out of Babylon in to stand with the 144,000. But the message that we're discussing here, it takes place before the Sunday law. It's designed to awaken Seventh-day Adventists to that they must finish the work of character development if they're going to be involved with this message. And I don't believe that our message is to go out to non-Adventists and teach them about how the Millerite, what the Millerite history was and how it's repeated at the end of the world. We do not have the time.
It's more or less based on a time prophecy, is my question.
What is?
You understand what I'm saying? If the Midnight Cry message was based on a time prophecy and it parallels to the very letter, the end of the world, the experience of the end of the world, then the experience at the end of the world has to be based on a time prophecy that was revealed, not so much now, but back then in 1840.
Were you here all weekend? Were you here on Sabbath?
Do I have to tell it on the tape?
No, it's not a problem. There's
no,
a lot of people that weren't here the whole time.
Well, no.
In the first one or two presentations, we went over a pattern, the 3-1 combination that pops up, and I know you're familiar with this, but I'm putting this on for the tape as well. A pattern that comes up over and over again in sacred history. The history of the Millerite time period is not simply illustrating the history of the development of the 144,000. The history of the Millerite time period is a repetition of the history of the time period of Christ. It's a repetition of the history of the rebuilding and restoring of Jerusalem. It's a repetition of the history of the deliverance of the children of Israel out of Egypt. It's a repetition of the history of Elijah, and on and on and on. And there's only some of those histories that are governed by time prophecies. And some of them, those histories cover a long period of time and some short. So if you take selectively the Millerite time period and say, okay, this is the pattern for the end of the world, you can make some arguments that, you know, we need to see more about time prophecy here at the end. But I don't think you can do that and be accurate with all the other patterns. And I don't want to.
It's primarily a message for Adventists.
That's how I understand it.
Okay.
There's a go ahead.
So then your Sunday law, I hate to extend this any further, but it made me think. So your Sunday law at the end of the world, which it extends an invitation to those who, through the loud cry and through the work of the 144,000, then those who come up to the Sunday law who are Seventh-day Adventists, it's similar then to those who come up to the disappointment in 1844 in this respect, that the parable of the wedding garment applied in 1844, did it not?
Right.
The parable of the wedding garment applies at the Sunday law, does it not?
Yes. That's how I understand it.
And then that would mean then when you read in Matthew 22, when the king comes in to inspect the guests, it would ipso facto mean that judgment has closed on those who do not have on the wedding garment. Correct?
Yeah. And if you want to get to the nuts and bolts, I would say that in the Millerite time period, he came in and investigated the guests in 1843.
Exactly. That's what
blessed is he who cometh right. To the 1335. Before the next question, let me read this into the record for to. Kind of justification for what I'm saying. This is Bible Training School, December 1st, 1903. The world can only be warned by seeing those who believe the truth sanctified through the truth acting upon high and holy principles, showing in the high, elevated sense the line of demarcation between those who keep the commandments of God and those who trample them under their feet. If you look at that one sentence, she says, the world can only be warned by seeing people who are sanctified by the truth during the time of the Sunday law crisis. Because the last phrase is, she says, the demarcation between those who keep the commandments of God and those who trample them under their feet. And the trampling under the feet of the commandments of God is the Sunday law time period. So she's saying the world can only be warned by seeing people sanctified by the truth during the Sunday law crisis. That's the summarization of that sentence. And then notice the next sentence. The sanctification of the Spirit signalizes the difference between those who have the seal of God and those who keep the spurious rest day. So when you boil that all down, it's not twisting her words or the grammar at all. She's saying the world can only be warned by seeing people that have the seal of God during the Sunday law testing time. That's the warning for the world that goes to all the world, and then the end shall come. I know that's considered heresy by some, perhaps.
Could you briefly outline the highlights of the characteristics of the midnight cry and how they're paralleled in the loud cry? Because it seems to me that the midnight cry came about when the hour of what they thought was Jesus' return, in other words, October 44, was known. Now, are we to anticipate that the loud cry will also occur when there becomes in some way a critical awareness of the hour Jesus' second return?
Okay, I agree with you. I agree with what Bert's saying and what you're saying, that there should be specific lessons that we can draw from that history if that history is repeated. But I think sometimes we miss the lessons because we approach it with our preconceived ideas, and I'm not saying you did it or anyone here does it. But what I'm saying is what I'm going to share, the answer I'm going to give you may be a little bit different than you were expecting. William Miller.
May I make one little addition to my comment? That means then that the Sunday law in the United States, when probation closes for Seventh-day Adventism, it, if the wedding garment parable of Matthew 22 applies in the 1844 time period and it applies at the Sunday law time period, that would mean that there's a repetition of that history disclosed in that parable. If it fits, if the shoe fits, it
maybe.
Right?
Maybe. Because you could stretch parables out of sync sometimes by demanding too much of them.
The thing is, if the wedding garment was required in 44 and the wedding garment's required at the Sunday law,
okay,
then there's a repetition of the history.
Yeah, okay. Well, I thought you were suggesting that both those histories should be seen in the parable distinct from one another. Here's how I understand your question. Here's how I understand a question to your answer. William Miller brought the first angel's message, and his message was Daniel 8:14. Now, I have a whole presentation on this, so you can go into the details for an hour. I'm not going to do this. But part of what you do at this point, part of what I do is I show that William Miller was a reformer and that he brought a reform message. It was a fearful message, and I use Spirit of Prophecy quotes to identify this. So this was the message of the hour. It was a reform message. But there came a time when the midnight cry, this is the midnight cry, comes into history. And I identify what the characteristics of the midnight cry are. And here's in agreement with what we've been told about the midnight cry, the Bible study by Samuel Snow that produced the midnight cry was a study that allowed the Millerites to recognize new light, new prophetic light. Before that study by Snow, they had not understand perfectly the beginning of the 2300-year prophecy. So it wasn't strictly new light. It was new light directly connected to the message of the hour. And the message of the hour was Daniel 8:14. It was new light about the message of the hour. So that's two things. Directly connected to the message of the hour, new prophetic light. And the third characteristic is when the light is fulfilled in history, the door closes. Because it was predicting October 22nd, 1844, and at that point the door closed in the parable of the ten virgins, and the door closed in the holy place. So when this history of the midnight cry is going to be repeated, I would suggest that you should look for new light directly connected to the message of the hour, and when the new light arrives in history, the door of probation will close. So for me, the message of the hour here at the end is the third angel's message. Revelation 14, a warning against receiving the mark of the beast. That is our message, right? So that's paralleling Miller's message. I would suggest that we should be looking for new light directly connected to the Sunday law message. And when that new light arrives in history, the door will close. And therefore, I would suggest to you that the new light for Adventism, although it's been around for quite a while, is Daniel 11:41. Because Daniel 11:41 is identifying that the next thing that happens after verse 40 with the collapse of the Soviet Union and all that is involved with verse 40, and we just barely touched it, is the Sunday law in the United States. And when the Sunday law arrives, the door closes. So what I'm saying is the light that produces the midnight cry here at the end, it's already here. And that's in agreement with what we've been saying about September 11, 2001, that the latter rain has already fallen.
This is not off subject, but at the midnight cry, they understood that the door closed, but there was a misunderstanding about the shut door and the open door in the Millerite time period in 1844. But one thing they did see was that the door did shut on a certain group in 1844. But yet mercy was extended to those after the door was shut for those who did not have the light. So at the Sunday law, mercy will be extended to those who do not have the light. Read it in Dan Steed's book. He covers the shut door. I was reading it just the other day, and it's a must read if you understand what takes place after the Sunday law. He doesn't mention it. But you'll see that the shut door issue is clearly marked out end of the world.
I agree. I've understood the shut door for quite some time, but when I read what he said about the shut door, there was other lights that come on. But let me tell you something in closing. We got to close here. If you're not familiar with the shut door, if you look at the pioneer history, October 22nd, 1844, the first thing that the pioneers that they were confronted with was the shut door argument. They had to come to grips with what they'd been understanding about the shut door. So immediately after 1844, the discussion that comes into history, in Adventism or Millerite history, whatever you want to call it, is a question on the shut door. What does the shut door represent? The close of probation, right? So this is totally experiential. You can't read anything into this. But from my understanding, my personal understanding, Daniel 11:41 is the new light that's identifying. New light directly connected to the message of the hour. The message of the hour is a warning against the Sunday law. And when that new light finally arrives in history, just like Samuel Snow's new light, the door closes. And in agreement with that, once the subject of Daniel 11:41 came into Adventism about a decade ago, there's no way to prove this to you, but it's true. The argument that comes up more than any other argument about saying that the Sunday law is about to happen, you know what it is? Does probation really close for Adventists at the Sunday law? Does the door of probation really close at the Sunday law? That's the argument here at the end. Just like it was immediately after 1844, the argument was about the shut door. And as we approach the shut door and things reverse at the end, they reverse. Before we get to the Sunday law in Adventism for the last 10 years, there's been a little argument about what the shut door means. Not much, because we're Laodiceans, but it's not an accident, I don't believe. We have 5 more minutes if anyone else wants to put in a comment or a question. Lloyd?
Okay. The last time you were here, you provided a booklet with your quotes. And when the earnest voice proclaimed that